Hi, everybody, and good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Tonight's broadcast, we're going to be talking about outcomes. I'm going to distinguish a little bit between anecdotal outcomes, some of the quantitative research that we participated in, even as it compares to other people in a very similar field. I'll also talk about qualitative research, the pros and the cons, the benefits of each. But most importantly, I just want to acknowledge that outcomes are a very personal question. In anticipation of this broadcast tonight, a parent wrote me the story, the narrative of their own child's journey in this process. And what was profound about it wasn't a clean, linear process, and that it was something that had a lot of ups and downs and two steps forward and three steps back. But what happened for them as a parent is that the change that it made in their life, that the outcome that I can guarantee when I talk to people, if you do your work, things will change. The outcome of their own perspective, their own life, their own skills, their own capacity, their own resources changing, that provided a context where the child was eventually able to make use of the things that she had learned, right? Realize those things that she had learned, and for today is in a wonderful place. So when we talk about even high percentage of positive outcomes, if you're that 1 or 2 or 10% that don't have that positive outcome, it still is a very personal thing. So I want to talk about outcomes in, as we talk about a qualitative, quantitative, anecdotal outcomes, but I also want to talk about the spiritual aspect when we talk about letting go of outcomes and what that does. It changes you first and foremost, but it also is an optimal context for others in your life, for children in your life that are struggling with mental health and addiction. Quantitative research is what most people think of when they think of research, right? It's statistics. And I was thinking about this today in preparation to the broadcast, that statistics, quantitative statistics, the problem with those are that the exact measure, 67.5%, is not really representative of any one person. You're really taking an average. So you're not really telling any one person's story. You're talking about trends. You're talking about themes. And even in behavioral research, right, in the social sciences, when we find research that's at the high end in the low 80s, if you're one of the 20% left over in that research study, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good the statistics or the results are. If you find yourself in that smaller section of people that aren't helped by a certain intervention. And so quantitative statistics, right, averages, aren't really the measure of real people. They're the measure of everybody averaged together. And if you happen to be unfortunate to fit in that range that's outside of the success range in a social science study, it still is a miserable experience for you. Qualitative is more like storytelling. What are the stories, right? Qualitative research takes a bunch of stories, a bunch of interviews, and they start to talk about the themes. What are the themes that are emerging in these individual stories? And oftentimes then you bring out quotes. It's not quite anecdotal, right? Anecdotal is very subjective. Qualitative research is more objective. But anecdotal begins to fill in some of the same purpose, right? When you hear enough people tell the story, when you visit our parent workshop, when you visit our parent support groups, you start to hear themes emerging. What are people talking about? It's not quite the same when I or somebody from admissions or a therapist evoke who's going to be very subjective. It's not the same thing as telling anecdotes, right? Because we can easily select out the themes that we're not paying attention to. But I do want to tell you this, and this is going to go to one of the main points. The reason that I tell stories and anecdotes is not to prove a result. I tell anecdotes to illustrate a principle or an idea. And so when I give you stories, I'm trying to share a concept that's hard to come by in terms of an explanation, but can be well illustrated by a story. So that's why I tell anecdotes to people. But what I want you to think about when you're listening to people talk about outcomes is, what kinds of things are they trying to teach you? What kinds of things are they trying to explain for you? So again, you can go to our research, our page on our website. It's a fantastic source for our research, and you can find additional sources there. Furthermore, if you want more research, if quantitative research is something that you seek, you can also go to the obhcouncil.com or the obhcenter.org websites. And there you can find research that's gathered from the field of wellness therapy across programs if you want to find what's most effective with it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the quantitative research, but I do want to speak to some of it tonight. First and foremost, I'll say, and I credit Dr. Matt Hoig, one of my partners, for this. Evoke, and previously Second Nature, when we were Second Nature, has been the leader in the field of wilderness therapy in terms of conducting research, not just during the program, but also in follow-up study. Dr. Matt Hoig, who's actually one of the graduate students that helped develop the outcome questionnaire that is used by all wilderness therapy programs, he's one of the ones that developed it. So we had that in our DNA. And the outcome questionnaire is a measure that measures symptomology over time. And when you look at the graphs, when the graph goes lower, goes down, that means that symptoms are reducing. So if you go to our website, you can look at those graphs and see an explanation. But I want to give you a summary of what we found in our research over the years. The first bullet points is that parents and clients report staying healthier at 6 months and 12 months after Evoke compared to after average outdoor behavioral health programs. So our results, our impact is greater even when compared to other outdoor programs. And the reason why I think that that's important is because we're not just measuring ourselves against other treatment programs. These are already normed against outpatient and community-based programs, but we're measuring ourselves against other wilderness programs. Outdoor behavioral health programs, clients report a 27-point change by both adults and adolescents, and parents report a 58-point change, compared to Evoke, where clients report a 26-point change, and adolescent clients report a 36-point change, and parents report a 65-point change. So our changes are higher, both the parents measuring symptomology, but also the clients. Both adolescents and clients report statistically significantly greater change. The YLQ defines reliable change as a drop of 13 points for parents, 18 points for adolescents, and 14 points for young adults. Evoke clients and parents report 30% greater amount of change than the average outdoor behavioral health program. I reported 36 and 65 point change respectively while at Evoke. Only about one-third of outdoor behavioral health programs utilize the nomadic model, that primitive living model that we use. All others include base camps or adventure activities. These add-ons make the outdoor behavioral experience either easier because of the base camp model or more fun. But we don't think that they make the same outcome. So the primitive living, the challenge aspect of primitive living nomadic, we think is one of the reasons why we show up better in the outcomes. I also think it's the family work, not just the amount of family work. And again, that's in our DNA. But because of the quality and what I'm going to talk about tonight with regard to outcomes and at a more spiritual level, I think is related to that when we get to the more subtle aspects of outcomes. So you can look at our website. You can look at the OBH website. You can read. I've given you a full few bullet points. For those of you that are interested in the qualitative study, that's fantastic. But let's talk about outcomes in a more psychological, relational, and spiritual context. First of all, I talk about this often, the difference between control versus influence. Now, in a perfect world, we would all be able to, I mean, this is a funny thing to say, be able to control our children's behavior, right? We would want them to make choices that were healthy choices, that were meaningful choices, that were safe choices, right? That's what all of us would want. But what we realize is that when we engage in a dynamic with another person where we try to control their choices, and maybe more fundamentally control what they feel and what they think, we lose our overall impact or influence. And so part of what we talk about, I talk about this in my book and in the on the podcast webinar that talks about control versus influence, is that the more we try to control, and in fact, the more we think we can control through behavioral methods, the less our impact on our children. And that is counterintuitive. We don't think that makes a lot of sense to us. But we learn to be authentic, we learn to be assertive, we learn to be clear with our boundaries. And while we might lose, especially in the short term, some sense of control over somebody else, we improve our overall impact or influence on them. I want to spend some time letting go, and that's really what the balance of this broadcast is going to be about. It's going to be about that idea of letting go. The simplest way that I can say it is this. That letting go means that you're trying not to control somebody else. And when you let go, you tend to show up more honest. You tend to show up more authentic. You tend to show up more clear. Your relationship with other people, it's a healthier version. It's more connected. It is more intimate. Because the presence of control, right, the presence of power, is exclusive of the idea of connection and intimacy. So letting go means honesty. It means authenticity. It means courage. It means action. One of the greatest misunderstandings around letting go that I deal with when dealing with individuals in therapy, parents and individuals in therapy, is that when you practice this spiritual letting go, that you become passive, that you become inactive. I cannot say this too emphatically. People who practice the spiritual practice of letting go are active, assertive, right? They're involved. They take action in their lives. They're not passive. They tell people how they feel. They say no. They set boundaries and maintain and keep them. So I think it's a strange kind of phrase, letting go, because in actuality, it's more about remaining firm and clear to your values, to your feelings, to what you believe, remaining consistent and in integrity in those areas. I think the Serenity Prayer is a fantastic exercise in letting go. I think most of you are familiar with it. It's a prayer that's said at the end of virtually all 12-step meetings all over the world. And it goes like this: God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Let's break that up. Grant me the serenity, the peace, to accept the things I cannot change. That means what somebody else thinks, feels, and does. Essentially, it means anybody else. And then grant me the courage to change the things I can, which virtually can be reduced to just me. And then, because we are so absolutely human, we have to pray, according to this prayer, we have to pray for the wisdom to know the difference, to know the difference between me and somebody else. And I think what happens for so many of us is, I find this to be true in the work that I work and with all of my clients over the years, is that the parents that end up with children at our program in so many ways have found so much success at being able to impact, influence other people, right? Whether they be a teacher, in business, whatever it is, their charisma, their character, they're able to impact and influence other people. And so then there's this illusion that gets built up that we can control somebody else. And I believe, this is just my own perspective and belief, that children in part are here to teach us to debunk that illusion that we can't control them. I remember had an extraordinarily successful, I was working with an extraordinarily successful father in business, just off the chart successful. And he said to me one day, you know, everybody, it's been so long since somebody told me no. For, you know, everybody in my life does everything that I ask. He'd gotten to the point in his career where he remained largely unchallenged. And that had been true for many, many years prior to his children becoming teenagers. And he said, so this really was a wake-up call, a spiritual wake-up call for me. My children were here to teach me that I wasn't in control of the universe. Like I said before, we tend to tell the truth more. I mean, think about that. Why do we lie? Why do we exaggerate? We lie, we exaggerate, we tell untruths, or we fail to tell the entire truth because we're trying to control what somebody else feels and thinks. Now, we come up with euphemisms for this sort of control, like white lies, or we imagine we're protecting the other person. We worry we don't want them to get upset, agitated, or reactive. But the fact of the matter is we're really just protecting ourselves. If we tell the truth to people in our lives, people can leave us, they can get upset, they can get sad, they can get angry, and we've lost all sense of control. So we tell the truth. We are not just more authentic, right? But it's not just that we're more aware of ourselves, but it's that we show up in the world and we show up in relationships more authentic. In my own experience, and this is still a work in progress, the more honest and more authentic I am, the more that the people around me shift and change. People that are attracted to who I am come closer. People who don't like who I am, who aren't okay with really dealing with another human, tend to drift or fall away from my life. Do we act with the end in mind? The philosopher Immanuel Kant said that in defining the moral right, he said we are to act and treat another person in every action like it's the end and not a means to an end. Right? We just show up as honestly and authentically as we can. And so I have all the empathy in the world for parents because, of course, we want the best for our children. And so it's hard to divorce ourselves from that desired end. But it can be illustrated in the smallest and subtlest of actions, even where there is no great tragedy. I had a father tell me one time at a parent meeting when we were talking about assertive communication and listening without trying to control what somebody else thinks. He said to me, you know, I tried your listening thing, your listening idea, your listening technique, and it didn't work. And I said, what do you mean it didn't work? And he said, my daughter still felt the same way. And I said to him, do you hear it? Do you hear it yet? Do you hear what you were really trying and what the real intent of your listening was? You were trying to get her to feel and think a different way. So we learn to behave in a way in relationships with every interaction as an end instead of a means to an end. I love the phrase. I've used it specifically with certain diagnoses with teens and young adults and parents for that matter. But I think it's a really good mantra to be reminded of, which is, in many situations, you cannot win. You can only choose how to lose. And when you embrace that mantra, that you can't win, you can choose how to lose, again, you tend to show up more honestly. You tend to search yourself, to search your heart, and find out what you want, what you need, what's true for you, and then you speak and express that. And what's the impact of authenticity? authenticity provides to the extent that we are authentic. We have the capacity for intimacy. So often, I get asked so often as somebody who runs programs where we separate initially for a time being, parents and children. I get asked so often over the years, what about connection? Where's the connection? And my answer is, we're building the connection from its most primal element. And this is true in couples, and this is true with friends, and this is true with parents and children. Intimacy. The first ingredient of intimacy and connection is an authentic self. A differentiated, separate, individual self. Most often we become compromised by sacrifice or abandoning something about ourselves, some truth, some feeling, some need in order to find belonging. And while we might find what we call belonging, it can't really be that if we haven't brought our whole self with us. So let's talk about your story, the long game. I could tell a whole bunch of stories. I could read to you parts of the email that I received from a parent who had the heart and generosity to share with me the story of her and her daughter. I could tell you stories from hundreds of clients over the years that I've worked with. But what I will tell you for myself is this. I was sent away to treatment at 16 years old. Left shortly after my 17th birthday. And it wasn't until 8 months later for me that all of the ideas, the skills, the principles that had remained dormant over that time started to manifest themselves in my life. Now, that's a relatively short period of time. 8 months for those ideas, concepts, and skills to manifest themselves. For some people, it's years. All you are all that you are doing is you're trying to give your children, your family, your best attempt at communicating healthy, clear boundaries, right? Your own values, your own truth. And that leaves an impact. At the worst, it's planting seeds. Or at least exposing them to an alternative way of living. At best, it's the cure for what they seem to be afflicted with. But that's all you can do. I've told this story before, but my own son, when I sent him on a private wilderness trek over the summer, last summer, not this summer, but last summer, I told him of our intention. I told him of our concern. I told him why we were doing what we were doing and what I was trying to express and accomplish. And he said to me, what if it doesn't work? And I said these words to him, actually. I said, I don't understand the question. I said, I didn't describe outcomes. I just said, here's what I'm trying to communicate. And everything that I described that I was trying to do, which is, here's what I believe. Here's what I'm not okay with. Here's what I'm not willing to watch anymore in our home. And here's what I'm doing. And I'm letting go of the outcome. Similarly, parents constantly ask things like, what if my child doesn't forgive? What if he remains or she remains angry or resentful? And my response is, and I'll say it more bluntly now on a broadcast than I can say one-on-one because it comes across as very insensitive one-on-one, is that's outside of your scope of control. Let go of it. The best way to encourage your child moving on is to be unattached to what they're feeling and thinking. And that might just start off as a skill. It might move into a practice, kind of a fake it till you make it. But eventually it can be a new characteristic or personality trait. Like, it's okay. You get to think, feel what you want. I'm doing the best I can and I'm sorry if it doesn't work for you. It may have been even been a mistake. So the long game is a long game. Parents will ask me in families where there's one parent who's sabotaging, you know, how to cope with that. My experiences, and there's no guarantee, and you can't control this, my experience is that children over time recognize the parent that shows up as an authentic self, a loving and capable parent. And they can distinguish between that and a parent who is making all kinds of compromises based on mental health deficits or otherwise to try to make the child happy. There's no guarantee that it will turn out that way, but that's the best that I can give you. The other thing that comes into this is if you let go of outcomes, you're already taking back your serenity. I was thinking about this today also. If you let go, you've already won. I used to say this to students in my group. I can think of the handful of students that were the most difficult, most committed to opposing anything I tried. And I would eventually say to those particular students, those clients, I would say, thank you for reminding me. This isn't a trick. I really do start to believe that I'm magic, that I can change anybody. And so you've reminded me again that I can't control you. So all I can do is keep my boundaries, express my truth, and let go. And I ask parents to write letting go letters that say something like that, like, we've given up on trying to change you. And while that starts off as a skill, I am really also teaching indirectly to the parent, that's the real relationship of connection. The real relationship of connection is, I can't control you, nor is it my job. So the first thing that letting go does is it creates a situation where you're focused on what you can control. And then secondly, it provides an optimal context for a child to grow up in. Let me talk about self and others. I talk about this a lot. I've talked about it already this evening. Becoming a self is the first task. It's being human. You can tell I wrote these slides this evening without getting them edited because there's typos. Becoming a self is the first task in developing intimacy. It's the first task in being a person. It's not being right or good. It's just being you. What you feel, what you think, what you believe, what you can and can't do, what you have energy for and what you don't, what you can tolerate lovingly and patiently, and what you cannot tolerate lovingly and patiently, and so forth and so on. It's just you. And then once that becomes an established project of yours, then you and I can consider being in a relationship with another person. The problem with most of us is it's hard to do both at the same time. It's hard to be a person in a relationship. It's hard to hold on to and to even know where that line is about me and my needs and connection and compromise and sacrifice. But none of those questions are answered with should. I want to say that as clearly as I can. None of the answers about boundaries and about selfhood are asked with the word should. And it's been so hard for me to learn that. What I have learned as I've grown in therapy, and I'll speak about it in terms with my wife, but it could be my children, is I do what I can, ideally speaking. I do what I can until I can't. And I try to develop a practice of self-care enough that I have more and more love to give to my wife or to my children. And when I find myself short or impatient or incapable, I need to practice some better self-care. So it's about being a person first, being human. Having faults and flaws, limitations. And then it's about loving and connecting to another. I think that's why the timeline in wilderness therapy is so ideal, because you start off with separation where there's only letter writing. You move to, in most cases, phone calls, and in many cases, visits. And then lastly, to a reunion and a transition where there's more contact one way or the other. We're starting developmentally from the first project, which is the development of self. Enmeshment, which is what many of us are accused of in this process, right? Enmeshment is not loving too much, but it's the abandonment of self. Enmeshment is pop psychology's terminology for what traditional psychologists would call anxious attachment, right? An anxious attachment is an undeveloped self, a self that is still suffering from woundedness and their own attachment issues. That is why we talk so much about you doing your work. When you find it difficult, and we all do, when you find it difficult to show up in relationship to somebody else, that means that some of your needs need to be met, maybe by healthy self-care, maybe by doing some therapy on the historical wounds and trauma of your own childhood, something else. Enmeshment is not loving too much. It is the abandonment of the self. It is anxious attachment. And codependency is a continuum, and it refers to the ability to remain an independent, autonomous self while at the same time maintaining a connection to others. And this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately. Codependency is not unique to families with addiction and mental health. I cannot say that more supportively to all of you. Codependency is not unique to families with members who are addicted or have mental health issues. However, it becomes a critical element of focus, since addiction or mental health problems are about the loss of connection and the search for the child for some kind of bonding, some kind of feeling of well-being. That behavior becomes symptomatic of trauma and or attachment wounds that have been handed down generationally. So I hear people talk about all the time, are we codependent? Is everybody codependent? And if codependency is a continuum, then the ends of that continuum are only theoretical. I'm going to say that again. If codependency is a continuum, then the very ends of the continuum are only theoretical, and we're all somewhere in the middle. We all have some trauma. We all have some loss of self. We all struggle with some healthy connection, sense of differentiation, that is a balance between self and connection. We all have some of that. And in all treatment, in all programs, all across the world, regardless of who the family member is, when a family member is asked to or invited to or compelled to, for one reason or another, to go into treatment for themselves, virtually every program in the world of any quality, of any decent quality, will ask other family members in, spouses, parents, children, to come in and to start to talk. And communication skills and theory will be introduced. And everybody's pain and trauma will be laid out on the table and honored and listened to and understood. So I know that there's a lot of stigma with ending up at a program like Evoke. I know there's a lot of stigma with therapy. I know there's a lot of stigma with the diagnosis that we all get labeled with in this process. But I want to say to all of you, so lovingly and supportively, you're not any different from the billions of people who aren't at Evoke. You just have the drive, the means, the opportunity to have your kid at Evoke and look at the things that everybody could benefit from, that everybody could use to improve in some way. could gain some value from. So look at the research. I kind of skimmed over it tonight. I wasn't going to go into a research podcast tonight. I think research is probably better left to be written and read. So look at our website. It's an outstanding source of research, not just at Evoc, but across the therapeutic field, across the wilderness therapy field. If you want something that is broader than ours, then go to the OBH websites. And I listed those earlier. But also listen to what other people are saying. What are they trying to tell you with their story? If you walked into an Al-Anon meeting today, or an AA meeting, or another therapy group meeting, any kind of self-help group, and you just sat and listened to the stories, what are they trying to say? It's not the literal story. Carl Jung says that the disease of our time is how we take everything so literal. Listen to what the stories are trying to speak about, to talk about. You might not have an addicted spouse. So when you go to an Al-Anon meeting, if 5 of the 10 people are talking about an addicted spouse, it's not irrelevant to you. They're trying to tell you something about themselves. They're trying to tell you something about a concept or a principle. When I teach principles, when you're listening to parents who have, if you're at Evoc and you're looking at aftercare and you're looking and you talk to those parents, listen to what the admissions counselors, listen to what the therapists are saying, listen to what the other parents who have been there, talk to the children and listen to what they're saying. What are the truths that they're highlighting with their stories? Understand what it means to let go of outcome. What gets in the way? It's fear, right? It's fear of getting hurt. It's fear of hurt and pain. The new Star Wars movie is coming out soon, and I just saw something on the news today that says there's some hint about the main character going over to the dark side. And I thought, of course, it's time for somebody from the Force to go over to the dark side. We're due for that in the Star Wars saga. And of course, it made me think about what does that imagery, what does it represent? It means that they're succumbing to their fear, the pain, the anger, right? That's what happens. So letting go of outcomes, I used to say that the reason that Darth Vader became Darth Vader is because his wife died and he couldn't take it anymore. And so he thought, I'm just going to control everything and then I'll never get hurt. And then you contrast Darth Vader's reaction to that specific trauma with Yoda. And I asked the question, what did Yoda do when there was pain or tragedy in his life? And the answer was he cried. And he felt it deeply. And I don't mean to trivialize any of your stories by talking about a movie written by George Lucas, but he's trying to speak to some core ideas in human nature. We learn to feel and go through our pain and our fear and our sadness and our grief and our loss, or we try to control it. Ironically, and he shows this in the movies too, the less we try to control it, the more we tend to have a positive influence on the world. Look at your family of origin yourselves as parents and discover what you learned about connection. If your parents are still alive, think about that relationship. Think about the guilt or the shame or the fear, the obligation, the rules that are unspoken. Do your work to find out what you were taught and start to learn that what you were taught might not be the truth. And the story that you were taught about life, the narrative that you were handed about life might be the narrative that your children are trying to break out of in a really messy, unsafe, chaotic way. Look at yourself and your impact, because that's all you can control. People ask me all the time, what about other peers? What about teachers? What about random people in society? What about genetics? And I say, of course, all of those things have their say in our children's mental health and addiction. But you don't have control over any of those things. So it's not really a great use of your time to focus on all those things, except for unless it's to understand or to empathize, of course, or to make different decisions with your boundaries with your children. But in terms of spending the bulk of your time about what children, what society, what the media is doing, it doesn't spend a lot of time. It's not something you can change. All you can do is change your boundaries, change yourself, change the safe haven psychologically that you build for your child in the face of all of those influences. And lastly, make serenity your responsibility, not your child. Make that your priority by the work that you do. All right, I'm happy to take any questions that have come in. All right. Starting with the I feel statement. Today I feel angry. I feel this way because my wife and I were asked today to take our 15-year-old son out of Evoke and Trotter program by the end of this week due to his lack of progress or regression after 11 weeks of wilderness therapy. It's difficult to view this outcome as anything other than failure, since it follows our son previously spending 11 weeks in another nomadic wilderness therapy program and 5 months in a residential treatment center. He has been asked to leave all three programs due to the failure of progress with three different environments and three different therapists. He has been gone for 10 months without much hope for finding himself anytime soon. What do you do when wilderness therapy doesn't work? What do you do when your child has a longer game than three programs? What do you do? How do you choose how to lose at this point? How do I, as a parent, let go when his therapist tells me to find another program? Well, first of all, thank you for that, and I'm sorry. You know, I wish I didn't have any other answer than that for you, because I think that's important. But all that comes to mind is this. And I don't know if you've done this or not, but, you know, Al-Anon was started by, it's expanded, of course, a lot since then, but Al-Anon was started by the wives of alcoholic men. That's how it originally started. And the essence of the program is, how do you live your life when a person that you love so much is self-sabotaging, is self-destructive, and seems impossible to heal? How do you deal with that? So I don't have a good answer. I really don't. I will tell you, I've had stories like yours that have turned out well years later. I can tell you that. But in the meantime, it's really, I think, critical. I'm not giving you the direct answer about what to do next, because I don't know that without a long consultation. But I will tell you that getting into a 12-step program of yours for you, if you are one of these most difficult cases and situations, get into a 12-step program in the meantime. And I think that the concepts can guide you. They can offer you comfort and support. You'll meet other people there who have equally as hopeless situations. And so I'm sorry, number one, in general. I'm sorry, number two, that I can't offer you specific advice about what steps to choose next. All I can offer you is the idea that there are other people and there are support groups for people like you who have lost hope and who have tried so much to help somebody that they love. And there's a way of being in those programs, those 12-step programs. There's a way of being that offers some peace, some serenity, some confidence, some hope, and some direction. So that's all I can say. Wish I had a better answer. Somebody asks, can you offer a workshop for parents a month or two after your program? You know, that's a great, great question. I'll tell you two thoughts I have to that. Well, somebody just invited me to offer a program for parents who have been out a year or two, who are doing better, but who still need work on enmeshment and relationships. Your question about offering a program for clients or parents a month or two after the program. I'm happy to. The problem is we won't get enough people. So because we won't get enough people for that narrow of a niche that are willing to attend, then what I have is the Finding You program. I want to say this to all of you. This is something I've done and all of my family members have done. So Finding You, the next one in September is full. If we start getting, we start filling up one per month, we're happy to do two per month. Right now we've only been, this is the earliest one has filled up ahead of time, but we're happy to open two. I would encourage any and all of you to go to Finding You during, before, during, and after your child's stay at Evoke. So my answer is I would be happy to create a program that fits the niche of parents, families that have been out of the program for 2 months, but we wouldn't have enough people fill it. So come to the parent support groups. Come to these, of course. I will try to have a workshop at some point in the near future. But every time somebody suggests a great idea to me like this one, and I think this is a great idea, I try to do it, and we don't have enough people to attend it. So Finding You would be the closest thing, and in my estimation, it's the thing that you can do that's the most beneficial to support your child. I believe that strongly. Somebody asked another question, where is the Finding You program held? It's held in a lodge in Park City, Utah, 20 minutes, 25 minutes from the Salt Lake City Airport. Indoors, 4.5 days, goes over 5 days. Starts on a Wednesday, half day, goes Sunday, half day. So it's 4.5, 5 days. All right, let me go up with some other upcoming events, and then I'll get back to any questions. I'll be in New York City September 9th, 7 to 9 p.m. I'll be in London on October 6th. More information to follow. I'll be in Chicago October 27th, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. We also just booked at the end of October. The second week in October, we just booked a time for the Bay Area. So we'll get that announcement out tomorrow. It'll be the 16th of September. The 16th of September, I'll be in the Bay Area. Finding You, as I mentioned earlier, I think is the best thing you can do. If you want to do an outdoor adventure, either by yourself, your adult children, or with your children, that's therapy light. Pursuit trips are that. These groups all here are free for people who need support, who have loved ones in treatment, not necessarily in treatment, but loved ones who are struggling with addiction and mental health. Al-Anon.org, CODA.org, FamiliesAnonymous.org, AdultChildren.org. If you come from a family that you feel like had a lot of mental health or addiction issues, AdultChildren.org is that one. Alateen is for teenagers, so if there's a sibling that wants some support. RefugeRecovery.org is a Buddhist-inspired, non-higher power focused 12-step program. And then NAMI.org is the National Alliance of Mental Illness that has chapters in every metropolitan area in the country where you can find affordable or free services or classes. And social media, all of these podcasts are available under the Evoke Therapy Program's name. On an iPhone or iOS device, use the podcast app. On an Android device, use the SoundCloud app. On your computer, go to soundcloud.com. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram by using the handle @EvokeTherapy. Or you can follow the Evoke Summit Lodge on Instagram. That's the intensives that I talked about, the Finding You. On Facebook, you can find us by searching Evoke Therapy Programs. You can find the Alumni Foundation on Facebook by searching Evoke Family Foundation. The Evoke Therapy blog each week has new content. My book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent, is on Amazon. Any other live questions that have come up? Looks like that's it. All right, folks, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your questions. I hope this is a helpful point of contact to all of you. Take care, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.